Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Beginning tomorrow, the attention of most of the world, and increasingly even here in the United States, will be focused on Brazil for the opening of the 2014 World Cup. As the soccer elites return to the home of the beautiful game, as it's called, my guest today reminds us that behind that image lurks one of the darkest, most Byzantine sports organizations in all of sports, FIFA, the governing organization of soccer. But today we focused on the brighter side of soccer, as well as a bit of the dark, with New York Times sports columnist George Vesey. He's the author of 8 World Cups, My Journey Through the Beauty and Dark Side of Soccer. It's published by Times Books. Vesey is one of the first U.S. sports columnists to cover the sport in this country, and in his book he shares his growing understanding, love, and respect for the game, as well as the spectacle of the World Cup, where 32 national teams qualifying over 2 years come together once every 4 years for this incredible tournament where some of the sport's greatest and infamous moments occur. Today he'll share his thoughts on past World Cups, as well as the chances of the U.S. in this World Cup, where the U.S. has been placed in what's called a group from death, paired with Portugal, Germany, and Ghana in the first round. George Vesey joins me today on Studio Tulsa. George Vesey, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure, Rich. Thank you.
This book, 8 World Cups, documents your love affair with soccer and also the times you've been covering this every 4 year event that captivates the world and is starting to captivate the U.S. We're kind of latecomers to the game, but give us a sense of how you got the soccer bug.
Well, I got the soccer bug by growing up in Queens, New York, in a very ethnic community where we had people from, I played soccer, I played it terribly, but we had guys from 10 or 12 different nationalities on the team. And of course, different nationalities meant different styles. So you had long ball guys and short ball guys and quick passes and deliberate dribbling, and it was like the United Nations itself, but without a translator, because our coach wasn't very good. So I got the feel of being on the field, of being a terrible player, and of watching good players around me. But later, I saw the great documentary, Goal, in 1966, about the English and the West Germans. And then I got to see a little bit of the cosmos in the late, and Tulsa knows all about this, but the late days of North American Soccer League, I got to watch the Fin de Siècle NASL with Canalia and Carlos Alberto and all of that.
Yeah, in fact, that league, which Tulsa was a part of, is the Roughnecks. It was sort of the place where soccer players who were never going to make it came, and soccer players on their last leg of greatness. And, of course, that was what the cosmos was. I think in the case of Tulsa, it was more the guys that just found a place where they couldn't find a place somewhere else. But it did capture a lot of people's imagination.
Well, there were a lot of footballers in the world, and I wouldn't blame anybody for trying to find a place where he could continue to play his game. It's unfortunate. Major League Soccer has grown it much more carefully and slowly, intelligently, and I think it will have a future because it didn't overspend, and it's getting good second level and maybe even first level players these days.
Well, this book talks about your journey through 8 World Cups, and that includes, I believe, an Olympics as well as a couple of women's World Cups, as well as the World Cups you've covered for the men's side. And these are special events. I tell you, I remember the first time I went to a World Cup qualifying match here in the United States. It's a completely different animal than any other sporting event. For one, the sound, because unlike most other American sporting events is where there are these roars and lulls, it's a roar from the very moment you step in the stadium. You've never heard national anthems sung like you do at a World Cup qualifying match where people are literally screaming at the top of their lungs, and they never stop for the whole 90 minutes.
What games did you attend? Were you your first qualifier?
It was the U.S.-Honduras, not this round, but qualifying for 2010.
Okay, where?
Chicago's Soldier Field.
Oh, I was at that.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was a great game. Soldier Field was practically packed.
Right.
And it was about 3/5 Hondurans and
right.
2/5 Americans.
Right.
And the Americans, when the Hondurans sang their national anthem, all of a sudden the Americans said, oh, my gosh, this is going to
right.
be a game.
Right. No, I was at that game, and I remember walking in into Soldier Field from downtown Chicago, and I think it was drizzling, as I recall. It was kind of and it was all those fans, and I was talking to the Honduran fans as they were coming in. So, yeah, that was quite a scene. And the U.S. has had to get used to that, to being the visiting team. It's why you don't want to play Mexico in Chicago, and you probably don't want to play Honduras either. I saw a game with Honduras and the United States in 2001, like August of 2001, where the Hondurans came in and just ate the Americans lunch in RFK Stadium. They somehow got enough tickets, and then the players did too, because the Central American players come in with an attitude, you know, plus Mexico, which is in North America. They come in with an attitude that, you know, for all the abuses past and present and future, we want to win this match. So it is a lot of energy there.
Now, you've also been to the qualifying matches in America's district. It's North America and Central America.
Right.
And you've been to those Central American countries. What do our players endure, say, in Azteca Stadium in Mexico, or, say, the Honduran National Stadium or Costa Rican National Stadium? It's a different animal entirely.
Well, I'll give Azteca credit. It's a big world-level stadium, so the security, the fans are not right on top. But the noise, when people stamp their feet, it's quite a rumble. Getting to the stadium is an adventure. I do a whole riff on that in the book. I went to a qualifying match in Mexico, in Azteca, and I came in on the bus right behind the team bus, and the fans are allowed to form a gauntlet on that feeder road into the stadium, and they're sort of rocking the bus, and then you get out. And I mean no disrespect to this, but to get out of the bus, there was this, I'm going to use the word, you know, small person, whether he's a dwarf or I don't know, but he was about 3 feet tall, he was drunk, he was miserably dirty, he was on a skateboard, and he was yelling and cursing and careening around the bus, and the police weren't doing anything to get rid of him. He wasn't a threat, but the point was that was the first thing you saw, like, welcome to Bienvenido a Azteca, was this character, and then it continued as you went in, and I just remember one of the young players was saying, wow, this is quite an atmosphere. And Jeff Agus, who'd been around a bit, said to him, hey, you know, hey, kid, wait till we play here tomorrow. And it was nuts.
Well, and sometimes it's even worse in the Central American countries, because even though it's smaller,
right,
the venality towards our Americans, there's a lot of hostilities that are released at a World Cup qualifier.
Oh, right. So I was at a match in Costa Rica in Saprissa Stadium. You know, now maybe it would have to be 97. And I remember, I think Lawless was in that match, and maybe Casey Keller was the keeper. And I remember asking them after the game what it had been like for them to be on the field. I mean, I didn't necessarily see this, but I know that in some of these places that they're sacks of urine, can I put it that way, and double-A batteries and nuts and bolts and stuff comes up. And then perfectly bilingual fans, you know, whatever the curse word of the day is, They'll rein it down. I mean, Lawless and Keller, they're tough guys, and they've got a good sense of humor, and they know that's what it is. But it can be intimidating. And if you're in the stands, like there's an open-air press area, people are nice, you do your job, but you think you're having a nice conversation with some Costa Rican fan, who, of course, speaks English very well. I mean, I speak some Spanish. And then just all of a sudden, it's like, well, you know, kiss off or something. They just want to continue the aggression into this. Now, I understand it. You know, the Dole Fruit Company and, you know, General Winfield Scott in Mexico. You know, we got a lot of things to answer for, and the only way to do it is on the soccer field.
Well, you've covered 8 World Cups now. Which one was your favorite?
Well, it's like a parent. A parent will say, I have no favorites. And then you extol the special attributes of each one. So if I go in order, I can't. I lived in Paris for a month. I lived in Rome for a month. I lived in Seoul for a month. I mean, it's very hard to say one over the other. The toughest one to cover was the United States, because the country is so big. I was taking red eyes and back and forth and trying to keep up. I saw fewer matches. For example, I was just telling a guy from Orlando recently that I never got to the Orlando end of the World Cup. And they talk about the Dutch being downtown at their Church Street station, the pubs and restaurants down there. And it was a huge, Dutch are always party people anyway. And I totally missed it. But everyone, and I guess I boiled down to this. The first one I covered was in 1982. I was in Barcelona. Hard to beat Barcelona. You can't beat Barcelona. And then I was covering a group with Brazil, Argentina, and Italy. And I do all that. Very far up front in the book, I do a whole riff on being there, the nights, going to a concert on my night off in an open square in Barcelona. And then Italy, to my surprise, beat Brazil, moved into the finals, won it. So now I sort of am a wannabe Italian, although I don't root. And I guess if I had to pick a World Cup, I think I use the word first love.
Yeah. Now, Italy from the way the book reads, it does have a sort of a spot in your heart, maybe for that reason. But, you know, the Italian team is always on the verge of disaster.
Right.
And yet somehow they do well more than they do poorly.
The word is ansia, A-N-S-I-A, anxiety. And they're always, you know, they're always in that mode. They tie. When I caught up with them in 1982, I think they had drawn all three first-round matches. And somehow they squeaked in by goal differential or something, and they just managed to get into the second round, into this group of mass extinction, as I call it. And and the fans were down on them, the press was down on them, the players weren't talking to the press. They were having a silenzio di stampa, a press boycott, and the press had been writing nasty things about them, and it was just crazy. And yet out of that came this anger that the players had toward the world and the media specifically, that probably to some small degree helped them play better. But they're always like that. Look, in 1994, when they were playing in the United States, they were being criticized again. The goalkeeper gets a red card in the first match by interfering with one of the opposing players, had to come out of the game. Who do they take out for a replacement goalkeeper but Roberto Baggio, the offensive star of the team, the genius, the creator, because coaches are very uncomfortable with genius. And there's always that stuff with Italy, and it's one of the reasons why I love it.
Now, this year's World Cup will be in Brazil, and there's quite a bit in the book about Brazil. Brazil is another favorite for you. From the Samba
who
lines.
Who doesn't love Brazil?
Yeah, the Samba lines.
Braga, that's all I need to say.
From the Samba lines outside of the stadium prior to the games to just Brazil plays the beautiful game. It
right.
really does.
It's true. And every 4 years, a coach comes in, whether it's Big Phil or Dunga, the great tough defender, comes in to coach the team. And they're gonna make things different. We're gonna stay at home more. We're gonna play defense more. It's national stereotype to say that's not Brazil's game. The fact is they've got great defenders. Their goalkeepers are always maligned. And Brazil is known for the Joga Bonito, the beautiful game, but, gosh, they have great defenders also. The question is, why don't they win every time? Well, nobody can win every time. They have won five of them, the only nation to win five World Cups. I don't think they're going to win this time around because I think that the political protests, and I've never seen in the eight World Cups that I did cover, I've never seen a buildup of political protests in the home country the way there is in Brazil. People have identified, and for a country that loves football the way they do, they have identified football, the World Cup, FIFA, the World Soccer Body, as the problem. It's one of the reasons. It's the reason why their favelas are being crushed right now, and people are being made to walk around. They can't get to places they normally do. And they're saying, why is this money being spent on a party for rich people, for rich tourists, when we're being squeezed, our bus fares are going up. So they have made football the enemy, and that's very different from any World Cup I've ever seen.
And that's so unusual for Brazil, because Brazil is a football-loving country.
Right. I don't want to put them with the stereotype that they will now have a good time. They're happy people, and they'll be happy with the football, and they'll get into it. I'm sure most of them will, and will root for the national team, and will love the games, and many Brazilian fans who have tickets will go. Inside the stadiums, it'll be fine. But the political buildup to this is different from anything I've seen before, and I don't think that's going to go away. So you're going to have these demonstrations on the periphery, and it's not so much up to the protesters. It's up to the police and the government as to how much and how they want to repress it. If the Brazilian players in their own quarantine, in their own little world, inside the barricades, training, if they get calls from their wives and mothers saying, you know, your uncle just got hit on the head by a cop crossing the street, or your aunt just got tear gassed going out to buy a loaf of bread, that's going to affect the Brazilian players in a way that I don't think we've ever seen before in a World Cup.
And this gets us into the dark side in the subtitle of your book.
Right.
My guest today is George Vesey, a contributing columnist to the New York Times, author of a number of books. His new book is Eight World Cups, My Journey Through the Beauty and Dark Side of Soccer. And this gets to the dark side is the ruling body of soccer, which
right.
makes the International Olympic Committee look squeaky clean by comparison in many senses. There's a new story coming out every day about how influence was peddled in the awarding of these World Cups, and not necessarily Brazil as much as the next two, which are in Russia and Qatar, and especially Qatar in the summer. That was a brilliant idea. FIFA is amazingly opaque as far as understanding its workings.
Oh, absolutely. It makes the IOC look like Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts, which in a way it is. There's much more real idealism in the IOC. There are people who see the big picture. Soccer, I have never met anybody at the higher levels, including the current head, who truly are idealists. There's so much dirty stuff and money and power going around, and things happen that you can't understand. Why did this happen? Blatter, the Sepp Blatter, who's the head of FIFA, set up a double election for the next two hosts, for 2018 and 2022. It begs for vote rigging, for people to trade their votes back and forth. The United States, I am sure, the United States felt that France was going to vote for them for 2022. Instead, France voted for Qatar. Oddly enough, right after Qatar was given the World Cup, France got a huge investment from the Qatari National Trust for Paris Saint-Germain and for the BN network coming into power, into France. All of a sudden, Qatar was France's best friend. I am sure there was some kind of, you do this, we'll do that. Whether that's legal or illegal, it's maybe not as illegal as the money that was passed to FIFA delegates to vote for Qatar, but it's still pretty shady. And Blatter set it all up that way. I don't know that he wanted Qatar to get the bid, but it's certainly, idealistically, it's great to have an oil nation, in the Islamic sphere, get it. And that's the right thing to do, to move it around the world to all the different cultures and regions. But to do it this way to a country that has so much labor abuses, human rights abuses, and their migrant workers, it really raises a lot of questions.
Well, let's talk about this year's World Cup. Who do you expect to look the best? The Americans are in a very tough group with Portugal, Germany, and Ghana. Ghana has knocked the United States out of the last two World Cups, and that's who I believe we open with.
Yeah, it's Ghana and then Portugal and Germany. It's called the group of death. There's always a group of death, and I think by pretty much unilateral agreement, this is it. And it's just bad luck. The U.S. is rated at a low enough level that they usually manage to get into two European teams and then a third world team that is usually pretty good. I mean, the African nations all have Championship League level players, which the U.S. doesn't have. So they're in a lot of trouble going into it. I don't think realistically the U.S. has a chance to get out of it with or without Landon Donovan. And I'd be surprised. The first game is the important thing. Now, Jurgen Klinsmann, who's a German-born, American-based coach of the United States, he scored a goal against the United States in the 1994 World Cup. He's a trooper. He's a smart guy. He knows his own mind. He's left Landon Donovan off the team. I can understand why he did it. He thinks Donovan's getting old. I think he also thinks Donovan is soft from Donovan's time in Germany when he didn't want to be there. Still, because Ghana's the first match, if the U.S. is anywhere close in that first match, if they need a goal just to get the 3 points or a draw or something, who would you rather have coming in off the bench in the 60th or 70th minute than Landon Donovan? I think people will be raising that if the U.S. stays at all close.
Now, Jurgen Klinsmann was also the coach in Germany two World Cups ago.
Right.
He sort of did the same thing. He sort of cleaned house. He brought in a bunch of younger players. And everybody was predicting doom for Germany, and they came close to winning it all.
Well, that's a good point. Of course, the food chain, the supply chain for Germany is different from the United States. And if you're talking about the young players, you're talking about guys already established in the top level of Bundesliga that he did bring in 2006. Having said that, I was there. I had a great time in Germany. And the German team, it was interesting to watch because they did exceed expectations. A lot of people say, and Klinsmann will agree with this, that he got a lot of assistance from his coach, his number two guy, named Joachim Löw, Yogi Löw. And Lo has now been the coach in 2010 when they finished third, and he's the coach again, and everybody agrees that Germany is equally well coached by him. So I think Germany, personally, I think Germany is ready to win the World Cup because I think that the problems in Brazil are going to work against the Brazilian team. They're not going to have the home nation advantage that you might expect. I think Germany is just strong-minded enough and ready to win anyway that they could go in there with the blinkers on and just say, let's play football.
Now, let's talk about the Spaniards for a moment. They won the last World Cup.
Right.
And I loved your description as I began reading about the last World Cup. You said you were hoping for a Spanish-Netherlands final because the Netherlands invented total football, this sort of beautiful flowing style of playing soccer where you're always attacking. It's very entertaining to watch. The Spaniards have refined that sort of model, moved to Spain, and Spain has immense talent. But of course, once the final actually occurred with Spain and the Dutch says, we don't have the same caliber of players, and so they basically tried to hack them to get death, and it was not a good final. You know, it's a final, but it wasn't that beautiful game that you were hoping for. What do you think of the Spanish chances in Brazil?
I love the way Spain plays. Having said that, they have now won two Euro championships and one World Cup championship in a row. No nation's ever done that. So to go for this fourth straight major tournament is unprecedented. But I think that they've got an extra dog year on them somewhere. That they just have been. I saw the New York Islanders, the great hockey team, 15, 20 minutes from my house on Long Island. I saw them run down after four Stanley Cup championships, and then they ran against Edmonton, a younger, talented team. And I think it's the same thing here. I think some of the Spanish players, Iniesta, David Villa is going back. I don't know if he's going to be a major player or not, but he's on the team. They have so many guys from the last 6, 8, 10 years of their regime, although not all of them. I just think somehow they're going to be a step behind. But having said that, I love to watch Spain. I can't say I root for them, but I just admire them so much, and I'd be fine with watching them too because they're fun to watch.
The other side of the World Cup is you see players at their absolute best. You know, players always try to play their best, but somehow in the World Cup they find that extra gear, and I think that's one of the beautiful things about the Cup. But there's also this other side that just brings out bizarre behavior. I don't know if it's just the pressure of the World Cup or what, but, you know, for example, if you're England, you can expect to get to a point where it looks like you might be doing well, and then you'll be in a knockout match, and your best player will get red carded for
it's a
thing.
Tradition. Somebody's got to do it, whether it's idiot boy Beckham in 98 or
Wayne Rooney.
Wayne Rooney butting his Man U teammate Cristiano Ronaldo in Germany in 2006. I think I say in my book, and you know, to quote myself, what is it with these English stars? and yet, is it them being out in the hot sun and in the summer that does it? I don't know, but they lose their minds.
Of course, if people follow soccer, two World Cups ago, France and Italy in the World Cup final. Zinedine Zidane in his last game, he still is considered one of the great players of all time, inexplicably headbutts his opponent right in front of the referee and gets red carded in the middle of the World Cup final.
He blew his mind out in the car. That's the only thing I can say is, and Zidane played what I now consider, having seen some YouTube stuff on Zidane's 98 final, played the most beautiful final game I've ever seen. Exquisite, his footwork, never mind the two goals on headers, but his footwork was so beautiful. And then 8 years later, older, about to retire, playing his last match, he gets taunted, and I'm sure that it was in Italian, and it was, you know, yo mama, and by the way, yo sister, from the Italian player, and he just lost it. He headbutted the guy. It's a lethal butt. You could stop a guy's heart that way. And he just marched off the field. So weird things do happen, and not every great player has a great World Cup. Sometimes they do. Eusebio, 1966 for Portugal, whatever, he had 6, 7 goals. It was his World Cup, even though they didn't win. And Roger Miller, the old Cameroon guy in 1990, they didn't get beyond the quarterfinals, but was the first time an African team did. But there's something, good things will happen, bad things will happen, And it's such a variety with 32 teams, you just don't know.
All right. From what I understand, you think Germany has maybe the best. Obviously, Brazil has to be a favorite because it's in their home country, but Germany is perhaps another favorite for you?
Sure. Argentina is always in the mix. Italy's always in the mix. I mean, Italy manages to grit its way through. Uruguay, Suarez. I mean, there's a lot of teams with... And then Portugal, Cristiano Ronaldo. Portugal usually finds a way to self-destruct at some point, and I don't know about him inside how smart he is, but what a great player, what a great athlete. And could he carry a team well into a tournament? Absolutely.
Let me ask you in our last couple minutes, you were one of the first American journalists to really regularly cover soccer. It seems to be growing in popularity. It's still fairly much a niche, especially in places like this part of the country in Texas and Oklahoma. We may watch the World Cup, but we don't have that love of soccer like we do of, say, American football. Where do you think soccer is in America at this point?
Well, first of all, I think using the example of Texas and Oklahoma, I would not tell anybody in that part of the world, oh, give up your silly American football and become a soccer fan. I mean, it's in the blood. It's a great sport. Texas, Oklahoma, in the fall, it's a great tradition. So you're going up against that. Having said that, I think the United States has discovered soccer as a quadrennial party, that people will go sports bars that normally would be showing football games, Friday night games, whatever it is, will go for 5 weeks and show the World Cup. I'm sure that you could tell me the name of a place there and all around that region. But beyond the four-year party, it's going to take a while. And while I love soccer, and I have to say, I love it more than American football as a game to watch, as a spectacle, the thinking process for me. But who am I to tell anybody, oh, give up that sport and follow this one? So it's going to be a long grind for soccer to ever get to the level that it is around the rest of the world. But we do have a lot of money. We have a younger generation that has discovered soccer. I mean, I don't know what it's like in that part of the country, but I know that I went to an AC Milan-Liverpool match in Fenway Park in the summer about 2 years ago. I was covering it for the Times. And I was running into fans outside the stadium with Liverpool and Milan shirts, and their kids had these jerseys on, and the kids had gone there on their spring vacation. Dad had taken them out of school, flown over, gone to Liverpool, found tickets for a game, or maybe to see Everton play or whatever, and people know the sport. It is now part of the lifeblood, particularly maybe in the older cities closer to the East Coast where it's a little bit closer to Europe, but it definitely is in the blood of Americans the way it never was 10, 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah, it certainly is. And you see those same jerseys here in this part of the country as well. George Vesey, thanks very much for joining
us. Hey, Rick, thank you very much. Those great questions.
New York Times columnist George Vesey speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He's the author of 8 World Cups, My Journey Through the Beauty and Dark Side of Soccer. It's published by Times Books. You can read more of his writings on his website, georgevesey.com. The World Cup gets underway tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock when host Brazil plays Croatia. The United States goes into action in their first match against Ghana Monday, June 16th at 5 o'clock. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.